We are again in a discussion of the qualifications. I want to note verse 7 of the text. When he says a bishop must be blameless as a steward of God, which is what we finished our study with last week. And then there are a number of things that should not be present. He is not to be self-willed, not to be quick-tempered, not to be given to wine, not to be violent, and not to be greedy for money. So these are the qualifications that we're going to be talking about here. Not self-willed is the first. So we'll go ahead and take the slide to that particular definition. And again, what we have when we have qualification studies primarily are word studies. And some of these things were also mentioned in our study of 1 Timothy in the third chapter just a couple of months ago. And again, we're going through them a bit more quickly today. I think that hopefully we'll be able to get through all of the qualifications that remain by the end of our class. If not, we'll finish them next week. But not self-willed is the next. And you'll notice the definition of this term is given by Thayer. Is a person who is self-willed is one who is self-pleasing, one who has arrogance. So this idea of arrogance, self-pleasing, someone would say, well, those are two different ideas, being self-pleasing and being arrogant. But you have to understand that there has to be an inappropriate view of self in order for a person to be guilty of such desires. There is a self-centeredness, a selfishness that comes with the idea that I am esteeming myself more highly than I esteem others. And I want to remind you of that text in Philippians chapter 2, that we not esteem ourselves more highly than we ought, but that instead, rather than looking out for our own interests, we look out for the interest of others. So just think of it in that way, is that a person who is self-pleasing is ultimately interested in his own desires being fulfilled, thinking himself to be more important and more privileged than other people. In other words, it's right that I get my way. It's right that these things happen the way I want them to happen rather than the way someone else wants to happen. And as a result, that's where the pride and arrogance comes in regard to that particular view. So I want to make note, first of all, is that this is something that is required of every individual. Every Christian should avoid being self-willed. We've talked about this quite a bit already up to this point, that many of the qualifications we talk about when we talk about elders, there are things that should be present in all of us. But we do acknowledge that because Christians are imperfect, that there may be some who are lacking in this, who struggle with this. And so they're not as they ought to be. They're Christians, but they're weak in some way, or they're lacking in some attribute that they ought to have. And that's a reality. But it should not be that one who is serving as an elder be this way. And this is extremely destructive when an elder becomes self-willed. But again, it is something that is required of all men, which I think that Philippians 2:4, which we quoted a moment ago, let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also the interests of others. Let each of you is an indication, again, that this is something that is extremely important. When we look at Philippians chapter 2, there seems to be a problem that existed in Philippi at that time with regard to some division. There are two ladies, Euodia and Syntyche, or I want to try to pronounce it correctly. I never can get her name right. But those two ladies, the Apostle Paul names by name, and there is an indication there was some dispute between those two ladies. He called for them to be of the same mind. And so within that context, there are these general instructions given to the church. So it very well may be that the problem that those two ladies were having is this idea of selfish interests, that they're being self-willed. There was a disagreement that existed between them because one wanted something to be one way that pleased them. The other wanted something to be another way that pleased them. It is unfortunately the case that division can exist among God's people over matters that are of no consequence with regard to doctrine, with regard to what is intrinsically right or wrong. There have been churches that have divided over mundane things simply because individuals were self-willed. I want this preacher to come to a gospel meeting. Someone says, no, I want another preacher to come to a gospel meeting. And a division results. I want the carpet in the auditorium to be this color, and someone says, no, I want it to be this color. And as a result, there's division and dispute that exists among the people of God. That's wrong. So the idea of being self-willed is something that is extremely dangerous, because it can make even the smallest of issues, the smallest of disagreements, to be elevated to a point of strife. When an individual is selfless, not self-will, but selfless, then what he's interested in is not to get his own way, but to ensure that there is unity, and he is willing for others to get their way in order to maintain that unity. And that's why it says, don't just look out for your own interests, look out also for the interest of others. And that's a way of avoiding those kinds of things. Well, when you have a man serving as an elder who is in a position of authority of making decisions, and he is concerned not with what others need or what their interests are, but rather he is only interested in his arrogance, in his pride, of what is best for him or what he desires, well, then you can see how destructive that conceivably could be. And so a self-willed man is someone that should not serve as an elder in the Lord's church. It demands that he be considerate of others. When decisions are made, they are made for what is in the best interest of the congregation, with due consideration of the needs and desires of the congregation, rather than what he himself wants. Just to make a point, because I think it's important, the same thing should be true with regard to a father in the home. One of the things that I think comes with the concept of love in Ephesians chapter 5, where an individual is sacrificial, he loves his wife, and just as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. That idea of self-sacrifice as a part of love should be evident with regard to a father in a home. So the decisions that he makes as to where they'll live, the decisions that he makes with regard to the job that he takes, with regard to every aspect of the home, he makes not because of what he wants or what he desires, but what is best for his family. And he takes into consideration the concerns and the needs and the desires of his wife and his children. That's a good father. That's a good husband. That's a good head of the home. And again, we've seen enough of these examples in this text of qualifications, domestic qualifications, which as they are seen in the home, provide evidence that a man is qualified to serve as an elder in the church, that we can see those parallels. And so I thought that it's important to bring that up as well. A father should not be self-willed either.
Yes, ma'am. Well, and I think it'll be brought out in more study here, but it's obvious that that excludes anything that is evil or wrong. Those things, every Christian, every elder has to take a stand on.
Let's make that very clear, because that's a good point to make.
It would be made clear.
When we talk about being self-willed, I think that in a sense, there is an exclusion of things that are inherently wrong regardless. Whenever the Bible talks about the authority of elders, there is nothing that is present in an elder's authority that allows him to set aside what is right and what is wrong anyway. So that's true. Secondly, when you're talking about these kinds of questions as to what I want and what another one wants, that, you know, those things are a part, at least, a matter of choice. What is best for me, or what I like best, may not be what someone else likes best, and so I keep those things into consideration, not sinful things. And so that's true for a number of reasons in this regard. It would be wrong for an elder to say the church doesn't want truth to be preached, and I don't want to be self-willed because I do want the church to the truth to be preached, so I'm just going to give in. We'll find a man who's going to come in and scratch their ears rather than tell them what they need to know. Well, that would be wrong. We're not talking about that kind of thing. We're talking about the pridefulness. Because that's prideful as well, by the way. Just to make that note, from 1 Corinthians chapter 5, when the Corinthians on that occasion were not disciplining that unruly member, despite the fact that Paul had given them instructions to do so. In other words, the Holy Spirit says, you withdraw yourself from that individual. They weren't doing it. That's prideful. They're puffed up against God. So certainly we'll make the point, being not self-willed, as we look at this, the interaction with regard to decisions that are made by self-will impacts the congregation. But that self-willed, of course, would have a primary application is not being self-willed with regard to God and what He commands. And so we must always submit to God first. But again, I do think that the primary application that is here is how destructive it would be for an elder to be a man whose desire is to get his own way, to things do it the way he wants it to be done always, and make decisions based on that rather than what is best for the congregation. All right, anything else with regard to that first qualification? First negative qualification, not self-willed. Okay, the second one then that is mentioned in this list is not to be quick-tempered. Not to be quick-tempered. And that phrase, or that quick-tempered word, and again, you're not to be this way, but a person who is quick-tempered, he is prone to anger or irascible. And again, we will say that this is something that is a requirement of all Christians. We are not to be soon angry. It's something that we are to strive to avoid. Just give you an example. In James chapter 1 and verse 19, James chapter 1 and verse 19, we are told, "So then, my beloved brethren, let each man," or every man, "be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God." The reason I bring this up is because there are individuals who will say, "That's just the way I am." I've heard that so many times when you talk about an individual who's lost his temper, who's hot under the collar, flies off the handle, will jump down your throat for the smallest thing, those things that are listed on the board. And you talk to them about it, and they'll say something like, "Well, I can't help who I am. That's just my personality. That's the way I've always been." And when it comes to, number one, sinful things, but number two, negative characteristics that are present in our lives, it's never appropriate or right for us to say, "I can't help it," or "That's just the way I am." Certainly, it may be the way you have always been. It may be the way you've conducted yourself. It may be a weakness that you have. But you need to strive to overcome those things. You need to work hard to change and alter the carnality that is present when those things are there. And so none of us can excuse our actions. That being quick to anger or quick-tempered is something that if you have that, you need to work on it. Because too often, not always, but too often, anger can be sinful. And the actions taken when an individual is angry are certainly often sinful. We are to be angry and sin not, and let not the sun go down upon our wrath. But often individuals who are angry, they say things they ought not, they do things they should not do, they act towards people in ways that are inappropriate and sinful. Now again, having noted that, sometimes people struggle with it. And it may be that a man is aware of it, he's trying his very best to grow and to strengthen, but he's not there yet. Maybe that some will never quite get there. But the fact is, to have an individual who is quick-tempered serving as an elder would again be someone who would be destructive. Whenever they come into conflict, because conflict is inevitable, it happens. Men who serve as elders are tested in this way. Either people become angry at them, or people are angry at one another, or people will do things that will disappoint you. They will provoke you, and as a result of that, someone who is quick to fly off the handle is someone who should not be serving as an elder. And I'll also note again, when we say that these things are extremely important for all men, there are an awful lot of men who ought not be preaching for the very same reason, because they're thin-skinned, and whenever a criticism or provocation comes, they quickly react with anger, and as such, they can be truly destructive to a people as well. So it's important not to be this way. It is necessary that a man who is to serve as an elder not be prone to anger. We will say that it is not an indication. This is one of those qualifications that are somewhat relative in the sense that from time to time, someone may have in the past or may have struggled with it in the past and have grown and become less so. But to say that you've never lost your temper is a requirement for you not to be quick-tempered. That's, of course, going a little bit too far. But the characteristic of an individual who is long-suffering and who is gentle and who is not easily provoked is something that is needed for a person to serve in the capacity of eldership. All right? Questions, comments about that qualification? Yes, Dave?
Yeah, on these qualifications here, that not being self-willed and quick-tempered and not violent would be getting too committed. I mean, normally we'll pretty well know what that man is like, you know, and not always. And as two or three months ago, I guess, when a lady brought out, sometimes you know what the man is like, and not like he's been appointed and been there for a while, and we see that in the case of self-willed, and we didn't know that the elder was self-willed until why he got into that, but I said we don't always know at the time he's appointed, but it comes up, and usually when a person is self-willed, then they get to the point of lording it over the congregation, and that goes in hand, and sometimes goes the other way, as we saw too, that they lording over the congregation, and that guy is self-willed. I mean, in both cases were there, but this is what I'm never supposed to follow that. We don't always know, but what we found out. And we did what we had to do.
I would like everyone very quickly to turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 5 because this is something that it actually was brought up last week, and I want to make note of this again. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, you'll remember he is talking about the importance of honoring elders in verse 17 and going down, specifically talking about the authority that a man who serves as an elder, especially one who labors in word and doctrine, that he is worthy of double honor, having reference to being supported in the work that he does. I want you to notice verse 21 and 22 of the text. He says, I charge you before God and the Lord Jesus Christ and the elect angels that you observe these things without prejudice, doing nothing with partiality. Do not lay hands on anyone hastily, nor share in other people's sins. Keep yourself pure. And in studying this and looking over this material, I don't know if you'll remember we talked a little bit about this, but within this particular context, that phrase, do not lay hands on anyone hastily, is rather interesting because we, you know, when you think about that, using the vernacular of our day, it seems that this is kind of an indication that you're not to be physical with someone, that it's a referencing to anger and that. But that's not what this passage is talking about. The laying on of hands is something that is done to indicate approval. It was something that was commonly done with regard to the appointment of elders, that hands were laid on these men. And so as a part of this, in the description or instructions that are given here, specifically as you look at the context of verse 21, when you're making these decisions with regard to who you're going to support, who you're not going to support, who you're going to appoint as elders, again, keeping in mind that chapter 3 and on down through here, there's this discussion with regard to who's qualified to serve and such. The idea here is we need to be extremely careful with regard to who it is that we put into office as an elder and how it is that we act with regard to them and conduct ourselves with regard to them. So, the significant things in verse 21 is that you not be partial in that regard. What would partiality do? Well, being partial with regard to this action might preclude you from having a man serving as an elder who's qualified. because I'm not partial to him. In other words, I may not have an affinity for that individual. I may not have a close friendship with that individual. There's another person that I want in the office, and so I'm going to be against the appointment of this man before the appointment of another. It's kind of like who you're partial to with regard to the candidates for public office. You know, I've got my candidate, and well, what about this candidate? Well, I don't like him as much as I like my guy. And in regard to that, sometimes it may be because of personalities, it may be because of personal friendships, that these things are so. But the question is, the guy that you like, is he actually qualified? And the guy that you don't like as well, is he actually qualified? And is it possible that you're being partial with regard to this because of some prejudice that you have, some preconception, some desire that you have that's not in keeping with these instructions and these guidelines that Jesus has proclaimed? So with regard to that, when we begin to examine these things, it's important that we not be hasty in making these decisions. There has to be introspection, prayer, meditation on the situation, circumstances, but primarily there has to be an examination of the man. And that's a hard thing for us to do. We don't want to be perceived as being negative when we're asking, is this really the case? Is he really qualified? Does he really have these attributes to the extent that is needed? Is there some area where he's deficient? You go and talk to a man about his deficiencies, that's an awkward situation. And so as a result of that, there is a tendency for us to say, well, he may not be exactly what I think he ought to be, but I don't want to be that kind of person, so I'm going to give my approval. So you can see Timothy laying hands on a man hastily. That ordination or that choosing of an individual to serve as an elder can be done too quickly without the examination. And when that happens, notice verse 22, when you lay hands on anyone hastily, and as a part of this, nor share in other people's sins. In other words, you can be a participant in that. They're not as they should be. They're going to be doing things that are inappropriate. They're not going to be acting as they should. And it's possible for us to be partaking in that because we've given our tacit approval to them when we ought not. And so, you know, what Dick indicated, I think, is an important point to be made. Maybe sometimes you can't know, but at the same time, maybe sometimes you do know, you just don't want to be that person who would raise such an objection. And it's a difficult thing to do. And so, as a result, a man may be appointed to serve, and that may be a hasty appointment in the sense that, number one, he's not qualified. Number two, individuals were aware of a lack, and they didn't examine it, they didn't address it, they didn't talk about it because of whatever reason. It may be the prejudice, it may be partiality that is present in that regard, and as a result of it, it can cause problems in the church. So I do think that verses 21 and 22 of 1 Timothy chapter 5 at least can have a direct application to the concept of appointing men to serve as elders, as indicated by the context. And validates what we've been talking about here.
Stan, also, there are, I don't have the verses with me in front of me right this minute, but there are verses that help us in case that does occur, how you are to deal with it. In other words, if someone shows himself to be not qualified, then two or more are to go to him. And those things need to be followed in that order. If this person shows up to not be qualified, what is to be done?
Well, certainly any kind of sins and all that are handled, there are principles that are found in God's Word, and how those things would be dealt with. Yes, ma'am.
We need to be very careful also to listen to our brethren when they voice objections, and they may not do that very strongly. They may not stand up for what they think in the matter. They may just speak it and it goes in passing, and it may go away and may not catch it. We have a sister present who did object when we instituted, or when we put up an elder, and her agree with you 100% about these verses here. If you go back to Acts 13, remember when Paul and Barnabas were put to work? The Holy Spirit is the one that said separate them out to this work. But what did they do after that? The brethren, they fasted, they prayed, and then they laid hands on them. And that's when the Holy Spirit told them to do it.
What?
So, yeah, so very, very sober-minded thing to do.
You know, and it's an interesting thing just to kind of go back into past experience and past history. And I've seen this in many congregations when a man is being contemplated to be added as an elder. The instructions given often are to, if you have an objection to that person, go to him privately and try to work it out. And there's a reason for that. And we need to be mindful for that reason. But, you know, that you're not wanting to. It may be something that's irrelevant. It may be something that comes from misunderstanding. And there's no reason to air those kinds of things when they're not valid. But at the same time, that desire for privacy and not to embarrass it would be something that maybe would lead to that kind of lack of communication and a man being appointed who is not qualified. So maybe in the future, we need to be, as you said, a little bit more mindful of that and those dangers. Very, very true. Anybody else? Okay, appreciate that. Let us go on then to the next slide in the list, and that is the qualification not given to wine, which is one that we've actually already discussed in some detail from 1 Timothy, the 3rd chapter. It's the same phrase, para oinos. The word para means to be near or in proximity to, and the word oinos is wine. So the qualification is not to be given to wine. And that's actually, I mentioned this last time, is a relatively liberal interpretation or translation of the text. I do want you to note that the idea is in proximity to, not to be at or to be near the wine. And some people will take the phrase, and inappropriately so because of the definition, they will say the not given to wine would be basically that you're not to be addicted to it, or that you're not to get drunk and act outrageously, that's all that's saying. And that's not so. It's an attitude with regard to wine. And by the way, the word oinos, just to make note of it, the word oinos is not something that it inherently is to be translated as fermented wine. In other words, something that can get you drunk. There are some mistakes that are made with regard to the translation. That word oinos does not inherently have the concept or the idea of fermentation. It's typically best to go to context, to the context in these particular instances, to determine whether or not it has reference to basically grape juice or whether it has reference to a fermented liquor that can cause an individual to become drunk. In this particular context, it obviously is referring to fermentation because there is a prohibition that is given against it. So what I would like to do is, again, read the text of Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs 23, verse 29, which is an admonition against being at or near the wine. On this particular occasion, he asked the question, beginning in verse 29 of Proverbs 23, who has woe, who has sorrow, who has contentions, who has complaints, who has wounds without cause, who has redness of eyes, those who linger long at the wine, those who go in search of mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things. Your heart will utter perverse things. Yes, you will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, or like one who lies at the top of the mast, saying, they have struck me, but I was not hurt. They have beaten me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake that I may seek another drink? Now, I want you to note in this regard that this actually is talking about drunkenness when the description of the individual is given. Individuals who has sorrow, who has contentions, who has complaints, who has redness of eyes and wounds without cause. They are individuals who linger long at the wine. They are those who are described in this particular text as, when can I wake up so that I can go and get something more to drink? But as the instructions are given as to how to handle this kind of thing, he says in verse 31, do not look on the wine when it's red. He's basically saying avoid it. Because at the last, it is destructive. It's something you need to stay away from rather than being at or near because of what happens. And I don't know, I think this is a good explanation of this idea that is understood by the world in general, is that when individuals begin to drink, there are an awful lot of people who just don't handle it well. And there is a danger with regard to addiction. There is danger with regard to having problems with that self-control, which is why you see so often those kinds of things happening. So what should we as Christians, what should our attitude be about this, is that stay away from it. And that's certainly the case. Again, it's not something that every Christian does as they should, but you cannot have a man who is at or near the drink serving as an elder in the Lord's church. It's just not right. It would be destructive for an individual to be that way. And so they are not to be given to wine. They're not to be near in proximity to wine, which has reference here to fermented drink. Okay? That's, again, something we've discussed in some detail in previous studies. Anybody want to add anything to it? Yes?
You've done well making the conclusion, but I just wanted to touch on this fact that this reminds me of Peter talking about all of those who would wrest the scriptures to their own destruction. There's a tendency when you want to do something, you'll find a way to show it. And the tendency here in this verse 30, they that tarry long at the wine, is to say, well, they tarry short, that's okay. It's the tarrying long is the problem. And y'all may recall, I think I've said this in class before, one of the things I've told my children is, if you will never take the first drink of alcohol, you will never become an alcoholic. That's good enough reason right there. You don't need to argue about whether it's okay to have an occasional glass of wine. Just avoid it altogether, and you will preserve yourself and your brethren the same.
Yeah, and I think there are plenty of scriptures in the New Testament which establish that principle as well. The idea we've spent enough of our past lifetimes living as the Gentiles live, and that which is characteristic of the worldly is something we should be avoiding. Yes, sir.
Was along that line, we read there in Romans, and what Dennis here was saying, go back to the Romans 13 and 14 that got brought up Wednesday night about in verse 13 of Romans 13 says, let us walk properly in the day, not in reverie and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy. Well, I don't do those things. But then 14 says, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fill the lust. No provision is not, well, it's shortly, as Dennis says, well, you know, it's carry long, it's okay to carry shortly. Well, that's you make a provision for the flesh when you do the shortly, and also when you're not on the bottom. So that's the same. You don't get involved in the, they don't get involved in the social drinking or stay away from it as you brought out the deal. And that's taking no provision is what that means.
Yeah, good point. That's a good application of that passage. All right. Yes, Mom.
Could you just touch very quickly, verse 23, Titus 5. agree and understand all these other scriptures we're going through, but I have had this one brought up to me before with people who are trying to say it's all right to have just a drink once in a while.
What's the passage you chose?
Well, 23, verse 5. Timothy, I'm sorry. First Timothy.
First Timothy 5, 23.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where you no longer drink only water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and your frequent infirmities.
Okay. So the simple answer to that is that, again, the context determines whether it's fermented or not. There's no way of determining in that particular passage as to whether it's fermented or not. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes it's obvious. Basically, when there's a condemnation of it, it's obvious that it's referencing fermented wine. And then there are times when it is spoken of in in context to where it's obvious that it could not be fermented wine. For example, in John 3, with regard to the wedding feast in Cana, that Jesus, having changed the water into wine after a period of time when they had run out of wine and everyone was well drunk, the idea that he changed that into fermented wine would be at odds with the admonitions against drunkenness. He would be participating in that. And so I don't think that that had reference. The fact that you saved the best wine would be an indication of freshness more than anything else, rather than the fermented. Having said that, so the point is that the medicinal properties that are found in this particular text, that they are available to an individual whether it's fermented or not with regard to stomach infirmities. So the first thing would be is that there's no way of determining whether or not this is alcoholic or non-alcoholic wine with regard to the purpose of the use. And so it may very well have been that it was fermented. There's no reason to think that it wasn't, because it was for medicinal uses. But the main thing to point out there is that this indicates very clearly that Timothy was a teetotaler. He didn't drink wine at all. And so here the reason that is given for him to use a little wine is not for the purpose of drinking and becoming intoxicated or of any social use, but rather medicinal. And so with these kinds of things, when you look at these passages, what you have to recognize is that you cannot extend it beyond what the context allows. And what the context allows for is for the use of medication. And that's about it. And there weren't many medications that they had available to them at that time with regard to stomach problems. And so this was a medicinal use. And we could say the same. We could make a very similar application with regard to the use of marijuana, for example, which is, by the way, becoming very prevalent. Why do you use marijuana? If a doctor, it's really interesting, just recently, it hasn't been long, but people who have extremely bad Parkinson's symptoms, where, I mean, they're just absolutely, they can't hold anything and such, they can use marijuana and the tremors go away with some of them. And that's a medicinal use of it, which would be right and appropriate. But the social use of it is something entirely different. And those distinctions need to be made. And so that's where I would go with that, is that that's a medicinal use, not a social use. And that's the difference or distinction. Yes?
It's on the tip of my tongue, but you know, sometimes the word won't come. Samson, he was one of these. He wouldn't be great.
Nazarite.
And that's right about. I thought, you know, back to that, when Paul was doing a lady, I thought there for a little while, maybe he was doing a Nazarite. No. We know that Timothy partook of the fruit of the vine. He had to at least once a week.
Yeah.
All Christians did. So that's not what he was doing. He wasn't forsaking the fruit of the vine altogether. He wasn't drinking it like the worldly people do. He was abstaining from that. My grandfather, like these people you were talking about with Parkinson, when he was dying, or before, I guess, he got that far along with cancer, the doctor prescribed him to drink a little wine because of the certain substances in it that would help him, and he followed his doctor's directions. He didn't drink it any other time except exactly what the doctor told him to do. He did it with a good conscience.
Yeah. I think he
didn't have a problem.
Yeah. I think that exactly parallels it. But again, individuals who reason in that way, as Dennis mentioned at the beginning of our time together, they have an agenda, and they want to twist the scriptures in such a way as to rationalize what they're wanting to do in those cases. And that's kind of an obvious example. Okay, anybody else? Was that the first or second bell?
First,
okay. All right. So then we have just the opportunity for one more. Not violent. And again, this is one that we've already discussed. It's the same phrase that is found in 1 Timothy, the third chapter. It is the meplectin, which is, or meplectain. I can't pronounce Greek very well. But anyway, the me or me is not. And the second part of that word is not a bruiser, not pugnacious, not a quarrelsome person. And in this particular case, now it's not mentioned this way in 1 Timothy chapter 3. It's not mentioned in Titus 1 like it was in 1 Timothy 3. There was another a passage in that place that was also not quarrelsome, which is kind of similar. One has more of the idea of someone who's ready to argue all the time. This one specifically has reference to physical intimidation. Not a person who is a brawler, not a person who is one who is violent, who is willing to engage in physical violence or verbal violence, which is the idea of intimidation. So again, it's something that I think we all understand and recognize, is that it would be inappropriate for an elder to be an individual who uses his physical presence to intimidate someone else. Specifically when we're talking about members of the church. The idea of a man who uses his physicality to frighten individuals in order to get his way or to accomplish it, or is willing to wade into someone because of some circumstance that arises is completely inappropriate. If you have a guy who has the habit of getting into fights and expressing himself physically, you know, who's to say how you would act as an elder in the church and in interaction with Christians? And that's something that would be completely and totally inappropriate. Okay? All right, so we almost got through the knots. We'll be talking about not greedy for money next time and get into some of the others mentioned in verse 8 and the first part of verse 9. So we should finish our qualifications next week. All right? Thank you very much for your kind attention today.